I plan to explain the basics of the X mechanism, which is an important mechanism in gauge theories, and you'll meet, you know it's everywhere, and you probably have about it. And so it's related to the issue of spontaneous symmetry breaking that you, I think you have seen in statistical mechanics. Well, if time, I might just speak briefly of some other aspects of gauge theory, but I think for now and a half is enough. So Higgs mechanism, well, let's say spontaneous symmetry breaking. And the Higgs mechanism. So Higgs mechanism was invented in the 60s by a group of people that I'm going to explain a bit later. And it comes from the question whether in high energy physics you can have vector bosons like gauge field, but which are massive, so which have 3 degrees of freedom. So the question is, can you have vector bosons which are massive? And I explained briefly, but you can see in the book in the order, that in fact, pure free, well, independent non-interacting vector bosons or vector bosons in gauge theories, so in pure gauge theories, that's not possible because of gauge invariance. And if you try to introduce a mass term, it breaks gauge invariant, and therefore it means that it makes sense in some gauge fixing procedure, but then you have problem with unitarity and positivity, etc. So it's basically gauge invariance is because you want to have unitarity, positivity, well, Poincaré invariance, you lose one of those, okay? But for reasons that pertain to the history of quantum mechanics in weak interaction, people were looking, have been looking for massive forces mediated by short-range vector bosons, and so they were looking for this. So, in fact, first I'm going to show you that this is possible already, and that's something which was known already in classical physics since the 30s. So first I'm going to speak about plasma waves in classical physics. And then I'll show you how this can be implemented in high energy physics through two aspects. First, the spontaneous symmetry breaking and the appearance of Goldstone modes, and through the X mechanism itself. Okay. So first, plasma waves. So plasma waves, the existence of waves in the plasma, so instability in the plasma, in fact, as far as I know, has been first shown by two famous plasma physicists. What is the name? Well, it's Langmuir, which is now very known. And Tonk, I think, in 1929. And that's the issue of plasma oscillation, or plasma waves, plasma oscillation. So I'm going to consider an ideal object, which is what is called a cold plasma, which means that you have a gas of positive and negative charges, typically ion and electrons, but one neglects the effect of the collision between them and of the fact that there are thermal fluctuations. So The plasma is hot, of course, because it's ionized, but you neglect the other aspects of the thermal property. Plasma physics is something very delicate. Well, it's complicated. So you just assume that you have ions and electrons, and you neglect anything else. Okay. So we assume that we have an ion background which is a fixed density, and let's call this N. And E for electric density. And we have electrons, free electrons. So the density of electrons, so that's the density for ion. And the density of electrons is equal to the density of ion on average, but it can fluctuate, the electrons. So we consider that the mass of the ions is infinite and the mass of electrons is finite. That's usually a good approximation because the mass of ion is the mass of a nucleus of an atom, and even for an hydrogen atom, it's much bigger than the mass of electron. Okay. And so let's write the Maxwell equation for this system. So, so the Maxwell equation are just that. Well, I'm using the Maxwell equation in the CGS units C equal 1 in order to not to deal with the permittivity, vacuum permittivity, magnetic permittivity, etc. So this is divergence of E equal 4 pi times the density. The divergence of B equals 0. The vector product of Nabla, so the rotational divergence of B is 4 pi times current plus the displacement current, so the time derivative of E, and the vector derivative of E is minus the time derivative of B. So these are the equations that come from gauge invariants, so the good gauge, the constraint which says that B and A are the derivative of a gauge potential, and these are the dynamical equation. Okay? And so assume that I'm considering the system very simple. So first I have my ion background, let me ion, which has a density, and superposed to it, I have my electrons. Okay, so I just a layer of ion and a layer and electron. It's a two-dimensional picture, but it's going to be in three dimensions. And let's look whether it's possible for the electron to move globally, so to have a global moves of the electrons, global oscillation. Of the electrons, whether this is compatible with the Maxwell equation. Okay? So, of course, if you do this, the density stays zero because you just have everywhere plus and minus. So, the density, so is it, can we have oscillations? Okay. And so, I'm going to assume that oscillation means that the position on of an electron, an individual electron with an individual electron minus will be x of t equal the rest electron some amplitude, let's delta x times sine omega t. So that's the amplitude. Let's call it delta. And that's the frequency. Okay, so that's the rest position. Okay, so each electron, and everywhere, each electron oscillates in phase. Okay. So then, of course, also the density zero, the charge density, because everywhere there are as many electrons as ions, you still have a current. Because electrons are moving. So the current is simply G, it depends on T, and it's, so it's minus E, the charge of the electron, the density of the electron, which is going to be the density of the ions. It doesn't vary because all the electrons move the same direction. And then there is the derivative. So V0 times cosine omega t, where V0 is the amplitude, so is delta times omega. That's the amplitude of the speed, of a velocity. Okay, so that's a current, which is oscillating. But it is homogeneous. It's everywhere in space, there is the same current. Okay? And so, well, E is coming, well, you see, there will be no magnetic field. In fact. But if you solve the equation, this is compatible with the fact that there is an oscillating electric field. Simply because you have to use this equation. E is constant, so this is vanishes. So if there is a magnetic field, it's going to be constant in time. So this is going to be zero. E is going to be constant in space, so this is going to be zero, because rho equals zero, so this is going to be zero. So you just have to set this to zero. So using that this is zero, you find easily that you have an oscillating constant electric field in space, which is of the form E zero. So it has to be proportional to, so its derivative has to be proportional to the current. So it has to be in sine theta. So you solve the equation, you find that it's E zero sine of omega theta, with the equation that E zero times omega equal, well, there is a 4 pi, so it's 4 pi E squared N E divided by W. Okay. So you just solve this equation and you get this consistency equation. Okay. And I got this, I'm sorry. Ah, no, I'm sorry, I was a bit short. In order to get this equation, of course, Now, I'm sorry, now we have to find whether there is a possible relation between E0, the amplitude, and delta, the amplitude of the magnetic field. So for this, you have to solve the equation of motion for the electron. So we just have to state that the derivative of the electron, Newton's equation, that this is minus E times E. That's the force applied to the electric field. Okay. And this gives you the relation, because we know what is V here. I've not written here, but G is minus E. G of T is minus E times V of T. So, taking the derivative of V gets a sinus omega T times T. And using this equation, we get that M omega, well, we can write this as V zero, equal 4 pi E squared N E divided by omega V zero, and V zero disappear. So it's free. You can have, this means that you can have oscillation of the electron of arbitrary amplitudes, but with a frequency. So V zero can be arbitrary, but the frequency of this oscillation has to be 4 pi divided m divided by m, the density of the plasma, times the square of the charge. Yes?
Why doesn't V0 appear in the expression you've written for E0 here? Like,
don't you understand?
That value, that expression for E0 comes from equating the derivative of E to J 4 pi, right?
This?
The next line, as in amplitude. Yeah.
Well, you can well, maybe you don't need to do this. Maybe you can forget about this, and you can just just use this definition for E. We know V. Oh, no. You need this, because you need to use this equation. You need an equation that relates E to the current.
Yeah.
So you have an equation that relates E to the current. But the current is proportional to the velocity of the electron. So this is Maxwell. And then you have this equation which relates V to E, which is Newton's equation. And once you have, you get this consistency equation, which fixes the frequency. There is only one frequency possible for this space-independent oscillation of the electrons. Okay. And of course, if you have, space homogeneous oscillations of the electrons, then you have also a space constant oscillating electric field given by this, because E zero is related to V zero. Okay. And of course the direction where this varies is arbitrary. So you can have an electric field that oscillates in this direction or in this direction. Say y, ex, or in this direction, ez. So you have electromagnetic waves. Well, they are electric waves because in this case the magnetic field turns out to be zero. You have electromagnetic waves with k equals zero. Their wave vector is zero. They are stationary. Omega equals given by this value. So let's call this PL for plasma. Omega equals omega PL. So they have time frequency. And they have three possible polarization. So this is a way to realize electromagnetic waves, which can be at rest, k equals zero, with a definite frequency. So in some sense, their energy is proportional to omega. So it's a massive, it contains energy, and with three possible polarizations. Okay. But the relation between the frequency and the is given by this. So you must have a plasma with a finite density. So this is called the plasma frequency. And basically what this very simple calculation means is that if you have a plasma, a cold plasma with some density, it exhibits, you know, spontaneous oscillation. You can exhibit spontaneous oscillation. So there is some instability in the plasma. And this is a phenomenon of resonance. If you have an electromagnetic wave with this definite frequency, it enters in resonance with the electron in the plasma and can give energy to the plasma, which starts to oscillate and in reaction create an electric field that starts to oscillate, etc., etc. So that's a typical resonant phenomenon. Okay. And in this plasma oscillations, the electrons and the electric field oscillate in phase. They oscillate with the same sine omega theta phase. So E electric field and electrons oscillate phase. Okay. So this is this phenomenon of plasma waves or long Muir waves, which is something fundamental that you learn in a master's course, if instead of, well, or maybe if you are doing a course theoretical physics, but at least in French theoretical physics, it doesn't encompass plasma physics, although it's also very theoretical. If you open any book on plasma physics, that's one of the basic results. Okay. So we have those plasma waves. So long Muir waves. And well, they are everywhere. Everywhere where there is a plasma, usually you have such a phenomenon. And well, let me give an example, which is very well known. Well, first, of course, this is if k equals zero. So you may ask, what's happening if you have an electromagnetic wave with a frequency higher than the plasma waves. Well, it's a bit more of a calculation than you have to compute, taking into account the fact that rho is always, you have oscillation which moves in space and time for the electrons. So you have fluctuation of the density. And then you have creation of a magnetic field, so that's a bit more complicated. But if omega is different from omega plasma, k turns out to be different from zero, so you can have propagating plasma waves. But a bit of calculation shows that basically, as a function of the moment of the momentum of the wave, the dispersion relation for the plasma waves starts at omega plasma for k equals zero. But they can propagate if their momentum is different from zero, but then their frequency has to be higher than plasma waves. And basically, this is the dispersion relation for plasma waves. So plasma waves can propagate only if omega, the frequency, is higher than the plasma wave frequency. And if k is very large, k and omega are very large, one recovers that omega equal k. That's because I have set the speed of light to be equal to zero. This means that electromagnetic waves at very high energy propagates like free electromagnetic waves. Okay. And that's because if k and omega are very large, the field oscillates very quickly. Since the electron has a mass, it doesn't have time to respond to the change in electric field. You have to take into account the inertia. And therefore, in fact, the electron don't move. The ion background doesn't move, but the electron doesn't move either. So the electromagnetic waves, if it has very, don't see the plasma.
Are these all the Alvin?
Pardon?
Are these the Alvin modes or waves?
No, the Alvin mode, I think, are something more complicated.
Okay.
I'm not completely sure. There are plenty of different modes in plasmas. But I have to check. I know them under this denomination. I think the Alvin mode involves also some magnetic field oscillation, well, maybe. But I'll check. Maybe you're right. Maybe I'm right. Okay. But in particular, you see that no electromagnetic wave can propagate if it has a frequency less than omega. No propagation. If omega less than omega plus one. And if instead of thinking about, if you assume that you are looking for electric waves with a fixed omega, you see that for high density, the wave do not propagate, and for low density, it can propagate. So this is for a given omega, or a given frequency, there is a critical density where the electromagnetic waves can propagate or cannot propagate. If n is larger than n critical, no propagation. If s less than n critical, propagation. Okay, that's, and in fact, there is a, if you want to see this phenomenon, just put some serious sunglasses and look at the sun. The sun is a sphere. And it's a sphere because it has a surface where electromagnetic waves start to propagate. It's called the chromosphere or something like that. Okay. And but the sun is a plasma, it's a gas, ionized gas. So it's ionized gas here and it's ionized gas here. So why does the sun have a surface? That's because, well, it's more complicated than that, but it's because here the density is larger than the critical density for typical thermal radiation, because the plasma has a temperature, and here n is less than n critical for omega corresponding to the thermal radiation. So inside the sun, the propagation of heat is convective and run by collision there. And outside it becomes radiative because the electromagnetic wave starts to propagate. Okay. So that's an example. Okay. Okay. So, okay, so this is a very simplified version of this, so the existence of plasma waves. And of course, this is a non-perturbative phenomenon. This is a non-relativistic phenomenon. Yeah. And there were electrons and ions, and the ion do not bound. So it's clearly a non-relativistic. Description here. And the question is, can one make it relativistic? So, can we have something which looks like a relativistic plasma of particles and antiparticles? So first, I can make another remark. So if I want to have something relativistic, I would like to have electron and positron, and not separating the ion. So if you have, instead of having ion and electron, you have a gas of electron and positrons, then, well, you can do the calculation. It's going to be the same. Instead that here, you have to replace n by 2n. Because when you have an oscillating electric field, the electron are going to move in phase, and the positron are going to move. Positron are going to move in phase, but in the other direction because of force. But that's the same. So you just change n into 2n, and that's it, as far as I know. Okay. So. So of course, in this mechanism, one doesn't need to. We need to have charged particle, but the spin of the electron doesn't play any role in this mechanism. Because the electrons are not relativistic, so the spin. So we can consider a plasma, a relativistic plasma, made out of bosons, but charged. So, what is the theory that describes charged relativistic bosons? We have seen in QFT1 that's a scalar field, so it's a Klein-Gordon field. So let's consider the Klein-Gordon field. So for charged Klein-Gordon particles are described by a complex field. So instead of having a field phi of x which is real, you have phi of x which is phi 1 of x plus I phi 2 of x. You can. So basically phi 1 and phi 2 are just the component of a U1 theory with a U1 symmetry. So they belong to, with the language we have in the previous lecture, to the fundamental representation of U1. So there is a U1 symmetry, which implies we have a U1 charge. That's the charge of Maxwell's theory. Okay. And then, of course, the action for a quantum field described like that is integral d4x, in four dimension. You have your the usual d mu phi, u phi, but in order to have something which is U1 symmetry, you have you need phi bar times phi.
Yeah.
That you get something which is real. So of course phi bar is just so phi is phi 1 plus I phi 2 and phi bar is phi 1 minus I phi 2. And then you have the mass term. So this is t over 2 phi bar phi plus, and then you may have an interaction term, which is phi bar phi squared. And these are the only possible terms if you want to respect the U1 symmetry. Okay. And if G, we know that if G equals zero, T equals M squared has to be positive, and M is the mass of the free particle state. Okay. But for the free theory, basically, the classical ground state is just phi equals zero. You have a minimum which is phi equals zero. And if you think a bit about it, in fact, the density, the average density of particles at the point x, the density is phi bar phi of x. It's the expectation of phi bar phi of x. Yes?
Are we in Euclidean or
Minkowski? Here I'm writing it in Minkowski, in Euclidean. But you can write it in Minkowski setting by here changing the sign and picking. So thanks for the question. But in fact, what we are going to discuss is the shape of this term, which is a potential V of phi. So what I'm going to discuss doesn't depend on whether I'm in Minkowski space or in Euclidean space, because this is a potential term, a local potential term, so it doesn't depend on the signature of space-time. Okay. So you have to admit that the density basically corresponds to the expectation value of the square modulus of the field. And that's basically because phi can be expressed into of term of A dagger and A operators for the modes of the particles. And the density okay, An involves products of A dagger and A, products of A dagger and A. And you can product an operator that corresponds to the density of the particle at a given point by making the appropriate products of two field operators. And it turns out that it is this operator as expected. So phi bar phi at point x is the density operator, well, properly renormalized, etc. Okay. So, well, as you have seen, I think, in statistical physics and in hydrodynamic physics, this potential, that's a general theory for a complex scalar field. And of course, in a theory, those are parameters. So we are going to assume that G is positive in order to have a stable potential. But in practice, T is a parameter, and T can take two signs. So if T is positive, the classical vacuum is phi equals zero because the potential has this shape. So here I'm using a coordinate system where this is phi one, this is phi two, and this is v of phi. And it's dark as a parabola, and then it grows like phi to the four. It's a function just of the norm of the field, so it's rotationally invariant. So, and so the rotational invariance is a U1 symmetry. Okay, and it has its minimum here. Okay. So that's a phase where basically the quantum theory describes small fluctuation around phi equals zero. So the density of particle is small. The classical density is zero. We are in a symmetric phase. Because phi equals zero. And the spectrum of the particles is obtained by, you know, having oscillations in two directions. So the spectrum is two particles of mass m equals square root of t, which is of course the boson and its antiparticle, which have opposite charges. Charge plus and charge minus. Okay. So there is a current. You can couple it to a U1 gauge field, which is electromagnetic theory, and you can check it can be coupled to Maxwell theory, etc. So you have currents. Maxwell theory, and what you get is what is called scalar quantum electrodynamics. Okay. But now, of course, you have to consider what's happening if the parameter T is negative. And if T is negative, the quadratic term is negative near the origin. So in fact, the potential has this famous, what's called Mexican hat or French wine bottom shape, where this is like this. This is the perturbative vacuum, but now it's unstable. And the real vacuum is there. So we are in a spontaneously broken symmetry phase, because any of those points describe an equally valid ground state for the theory. Okay. So in this case, you have an ensemble of possible ground states or vacua of the theory, which are characterized by the fact that the expectation value of phi, which is a complex field, can be now some phi naught, which is going to be the radius of the circles, times an arbitrary phase. Phase. And well, you solve this equation by finding the minimum, and you find that phi naught is square root of minus 2t divided by g. This is positive, remember? Okay. And so you have an ensemble of ground states that I can label by this angle alpha. And they are physically, they are inequivalent. This is a vacua, this is another vacua, but they have the same property because you have the U1 symmetry that relates all of them. So the property of the theory in this vacua is the same as the property of the theory in this vacua. Okay. But they are inequivalent in the sense that if you start from the full theory and try to construct it, they correspond to what mathematical physicists call a superselection sector.
I have a question.
Yes.
Now going back to the plasma thing.
Yes.
There we had a symmetry breaking, right? When we have like the oscillations on different planes, is that a symmetry breaking?
No, that has nothing to do with what I'm talking about.
Yeah, no, but it was...
Here there is an instability.
So what, sorry?
There is an instability because if you start from a plasma where there is no electric field,
it won't move.
You perturb it a bit, you send an electromagnetic wave with the right frequency, and it will develop plasma waves in it.
Okay. But it won't do it by itself.
But they do not develop spontaneously. The plasma is not in an unstable phase, mm-hmm. so that if you perturb it a little bit, suddenly the waves will appear mm-hmm. and grow in amplitude. You create plasma waves by transferring energy on it, but that's, for instance, you can play the opposite. You know, imagine that you have a big laser and you send energy on the sun. In fact, this is done in experiments, like in laser fusion. You have a plasma in a bottle, and you send electromagnetic radiation. In tokamak or things like that. And if you send them with the right frequency, mm-hmm. you start to create oscillation in the plasma by this mechanism of resonance. So the energy goes from the incident electromagnetic waves to the plasma instead of being reflected. And that's a way to heat the plasma. But it's a resonance, but it's not an instability. An instability would be, for instance, if you have if you have supercooled water, you send a tiny perturbation, and it goes to the more stable ice state and sending back energy to the outside. Okay. So now let's consider what's happening what's the spectrum of the theory looks like. So what are the quantum oscillations near this point? So for that, first we can write, instead of writing things in terms of T and G, I can write the potential V as G over 8 phi bar 5x minus phi 0 squared, because it's phi 0, which is a relevant quantity. Okay, so it's equivalent to this. And let's assume that I'm expanding the theory around the vacuum where alpha equals 0. So I'm study quantum fluctuations. Around the vacuum alpha equals zero. So this means that the field phi, the expectation value of the field phi and the vacuum zero is going to be phi zero and no imaginary part. Okay. So it's phi zero, zero, if you want. If I'm using the representation as a doublet instead of okay. So somewhere in the complex plane, phi plane, I'm here. This is a vacuum, phi naught. Real part, imaginary part. And I want to study, and that's a stable vacuum. Okay. So now it means that I can write a general configuration of the phi, phi of x as phi zero plus some perturbation, I call it sigma of x, and another perturbation that I'm going to call pi of x. So sigma are fluctuation in this direction, and pi are fluctuation in this transverse direction. And remember, the set of classical vacua is here. Well, you do a bit of the calculation, you expand, and you find that the action becomes integral d4x, then you have one half of d mu pi squared. Well, the kinetic term doesn't change. You have one half of d mu sigma squared. Okay, but then when you expand the potential in the direction of sigma has a curvature. So you get a g over 2 phi 0 squared, the expectation value of the field, sigma squared. And then you get nonlinear term, which are, if you compute, pi squared plus g over 8 sigma 4. Oh, I'm sorry, pi 4, sigma 4. And then you have interaction term. Sigma cube, phi zero, g over 2, phi zero, sigma pi squared, and g over 4, pi squared, sigma squared. Those are interaction terms. Okay, so those are interactions. Between the pi and sigma. And this is a kinetic term of the pi. And you see that in this direction, pi is massless, while sigma is massive with a mass of the sigma field, which is the square of this. So that's phi zero, the square root of g times phi zero. Okay. And this is simply, this reflects simply the fact that the potential for the potential is flat in this direction and is parabolic in this direction. Yes?
Is it possible for the ground state to be a superposition of different vacuum?
No, because of the because this corresponds to superselection sectors. It's not a real explanation, but the concept of vacuum is suppose that you are in infinite dimensional space. And therefore, it's not like if you have a quantum system located in a tiny area of space-time, like a spin or a qubit, etc., then if it has different states, you can make superposition of them. If you are in an infinite dimensional space or in a system with an infinite number of degrees of freedom, you have mathematical obstruction to that because the Hilbert space is infinite dimensional. So, as far as I know, if you are trying to do mathematical quantum mechanics, it doesn't make sense to speak about the quantum superposition different ground state. Or more precisely, if you try to perform a quantum superposition of ground state and try to measure physical observable on this, you'll get the same result that if they were in a statistical superposition. You don't see the interference, the quantum correlation between them, because the space is infinite, therefore the quantum superposition is so complicated that they cancel out. So the density matrix, you cannot consider a density metric with off-diagonal state between two different vacuums. Okay, so we have a massless boson, Goldstone boson, which corresponds to, okay, it's mass, I'm sorry, massive. I'm writing very poorly. So this massless field is called the Goldstone boson. And this is called the massive radial field, sigma field. Okay. So the fact that when there is spontaneous symmetry breaking, this is denoted by this acronym SSB, this has been discovered in the 60s, I think, by of beginning of the 60s, by Nambu and Goldstone. Okay, and that's a very important feature both in condensed matter and high energy physics. In condensed matter, this is called spin wave. But mathematically, this is the same object. Okay. And in fact, here there is only one Goldstone boson. But in general, if you have a theory with a group of symmetry, group G of symmetry, which is spontaneously broken into a subgroup H, where the symmetry is realized only exactly for a subgroup of the group G, then the Goldstone bosons, the Goldstone particles, or Goldstone lives in the quotient space G, I'm sorry, the quotient space G quotiented by H, which is a symmetric space. Okay. So this is an example here where U1 has been broken into nothing, the identity group. And therefore, this is one dimensional, this is zero dimensional. Therefore, you have one Goldstone boson. But if you play the same game with a model with a group of symmetry On, for instance, and you broke it into On minus one, the quotient space On divided by On minus one is a sphere of dimension S, N. And you have N minus one, I'm sorry. And you have N minus one Goldstone bosons. Okay. So. And you have to remember finally that the Goldstone, this is not, you cannot treat the Goldstone boson on a free theory except if you are very small energy because it's coupled to the field. So you have a self-interaction between the Goldstone boson, you have a self-interaction for the sigma mode, the massive sigma mode, and you have interaction between the Goldstones and the sigma mode, whose coefficients are fixed by the symmetry. You cannot take them independent. Okay, so now that was the second part, Goldstone symmetry And so now, remember, this is a U1 field. So the question is, what happens when if this this field phi is coupled to a U1 gauge field? And that's where the X mechanism takes place. And okay, so having a U1 gauge field means that I had a gauge field A mu. Here it's just an ordinary Maxwell field, so it has no no group indices, so it's just one vector potential, and we have to replace d mu phi in the action by the covariant derivative d mu of phi equals the ordinary derivative plus I, the charge of the particles of times a mu of phi times phi. So here the charge appears. Here, the charge is not measured, so you can take it to be one. Okay, so which this induces that, and you have in addition, of course, the ordinary Maxwell action A, which reads. Integral d mu a nu minus d nu a mu squared. So the theory is now described first by the action for the scalar field, scalar complex field with the ordinary derivative replaced by covariant derivative, and the ordinary Maxwell action for the gauge scalar propagation. It's a U1 gauge theory, so you have no complicated couplings between the gauge field. But it's me who thinks that, I'm sorry. I thought it was one of you. It's my bunk. Okay. And so this means that you have the ordinary propagator for the photon, and you have a coupling between the which is similar to the one for electrons. So but there is a derivative here, and you have a two photon coupling with a charge field. So the charge field has a charge. So one has to consider a flow of charge. This is means that there is a k mu term here. So, and then we have the ordinary term. So if t is positive, we would have just this. We would have the propagator for the charge field, and we would have the vertex, which it turns out to be something like that. For phi. This is the propagator for phi, this is A, and this is the A phi coupling. Okay. Okay, so now the issue is that if you try to think of what's going on, the theory is gauge invariant. It means that you can change a mu a mu plus ordinary derivative of alpha, where alpha is the gauge parameter into the field, and simultaneously change phi into phi e I alpha and phi bar into phi bar e minus I alpha. So alpha is a function of x, arbitrary. And making this change over this change, the arbitrary alpha does not change the physics. So leads to a same physical theory. That the idea of gauge invariance. Gauge invariance is the fact that describing the physics in terms of gauge potential is very convenient, but it's an over description of the field. Okay. And okay, that's as long as t is positive, that's not a problem. As long as t is positive, not a problem. Because there is a single physical vacuum zero, which is the ground state. But if t, so if you have a spontaneous symmetry breaking, t negative, then you have different vacua labeled by an angle, which well, I use the same notation. But, well, it's not too bad, because it means that by if you have a vacuum alpha by a gauge transformation, you get to the same vacuum, the vacuum that I've been considering here, alpha equals zero. So, because of gauge symmetry, there should be only one vacuum. But if there is only one vacuum, there shouldn't be supersymmetry breaking, because, well, this kind of calculation, but it can make be in general, means in general, if there is supersymmetry breaking, there should be several vacuums. And then there should be Goldstone modes. So, what's happening?
Sorry.
Yes.
Why should there only be one vacuum?
Pardon?
Why should there only be one vacuum?
Because the different vacua that you obtained, all physical, all states, if they are equivalent, even classical field configuration, if they are equivalent by gauge transformation, are the same physical transformation. So for instance, you know, if you have some AMU and out of AMU, you describe an electric field and a magnetic field. If you make a gauge transformation, you get the same EA.
So, but if you had more than one vacuum, you wouldn't get the same?
If you had one vacuum, the vacuum in quantum in Maxwell theory is E equal B equal zero. So there is only one vacuum in Maxwell theory. And of course, AMU equals zero is a way to describe a vacuum, but AMU equal d mu alpha, or an arbitrary alpha, is also a way to describe this vacuum. And in non-abelian gauge theory, it's even worse, because you can have a topologically inequivalent configuration, which are supposed to be also the vacuum. Okay. So what's going on? Well, the idea of the X mechanism is to show that, in fact, this is not inconsistent. So I'm going to present what the calculation, what you should do in the U1 case. But this extends to non-abelian symmetries. OK, so we have this system where we have a field phi, and we have a and phi. Okay. And in theory, in the calculation, we have this potential. So when you integrate over phi, it can be anywhere in the plane. So the idea is that, so this is phi 1, this is phi 2. A priori, phi can take any value. And the point is that if you have a configuration phi of x arbitrary, where phi is a complex number, okay? So let's call phi 1, phi 2 of x. This is phi of x. So it's for a given x is somewhere here. Phi. For x field, x fixed, we can make a gauge transformation. By an angle equal minus the argument of phi of x. So that it comes there. So here, this is something a bit subtle. It's a gauge fixing condition which depends on the field phi. So that's not the kind of things we did before, where we had a gauge fixing condition which is absolute. It was d mu of a mu equals zero, for instance. Here it's a gauge fixing condition that depends on phi. But that's perfectly allowed by the formalism. Okay, so this means that if we do that, we start from the action here, but we consider only field phi of x, which are, well, complex, which are phi zero plus h of x. I'm going to call the sigma field h of x and zero. So gauge fixing implies pi of x equals zero. So in the original theory where there was only one phi field, phi was a physical field. But now when I coupled phi to a mu in such a way that the symmetry becomes a local U1 symmetry for gauge symmetries, then there is no phi field anymore. It's absorbed in gauge transformation. But there is still a mu, of course. And so there's still a mu, of course. And what is d mu of phi? So d mu of phi becomes just d mu of phi zero plus h of x, because pi equals zero. Phi zero is just the expectation value, so it's just non-zero. D mu of phi zero plus h of x is, of course, d mu of h of x, because this is a constant. And this is the ordinary derivative d mu of h minus e. Oh, no, this is not d mu of h. D mu of phi zero plus h of x becomes d mu of h plus I e a mu times this. So this is phi zero plus I e a mu h of x. And therefore, the kinetic term d mu phi mu phi bar becomes the product of this by its complex conjugate. Phi 0 plus h times d mu of phi 0 plus h bar. And if you make the calculation, this is going to be simply d mu, the ordinary derivative of d mu squared. Well, so you have the square of that, which is e squared phi 0 squared a mu squared. Then you have e squared a mu squared times h squared plus 2 e squared phi 0 a mu squared h. And the other terms, I think, disappear. Okay. So the kinetic term for phi becomes this. The potential term for phi becomes V of h equal g divided by 8 phi 0 squared minus h squared squared. Okay. And the Maxwell term, is unchanged. It's just d nu a nu minus d nu a nu square. So the action using this gauge fixing involves so what do we have now? Once we have made the gauge fixing, we have our vector field a mu of x. And we are our transverse field with h of x, which is a scalar. So this is a vector, so it's spin one. And this is a real spin zero field, so it has no charge. It's a real, so no charge. Okay, but now look about what are the quadratic terms for the fields in the action. For the h term, for h, we have 1 half of d mu h square, which can come from this term. And we have these terms, no, I'm sorry, this is not phi naught. No, this is not phi not minus h squared. Okay, this is not this term, I'm sorry. This is this is phi squared minus phi 0 plus h square. Of course. So it starts with a 2 phi 0 h square. Yeah, so this is g 8 2 h phi 0 plus h square. So we get this plus g over 8 times 4, so g over 2, phi 0 squared, h squared. Yeah. Plus higher order terms, okay? And for A mu, what we have is that this term that comes from the Maxwell theory, d mu A mu minus d mu A mu squared, but we have these terms that comes from the covariant derivative of phi and from the fact that phi has an expectation value. This term, 1/2. Well, there is a 1/2, in fact. So we have plus e squared phi 0 squared mu squared. So this is the ordinary derivative for vector field. And this is a mass term from the vector field. You see, because it's quadratic in mu squared. That's the term we want to avoid in usual gauge theory. Here it's there because of the coupling of the gauge field with the matter field. And so what we have is that the vector field becomes massive. It's massive with a mass m of a, which is the square root of this. So it's e phi 0. And the x field, well, h is massive, with a mass for this h field, which is basically e phi 0. That's the same formula. Well, that's almost the same formula. No, there is no square root of g. I'm sorry. So that's the same formula that in the theory which was uncoupled to the electromagnetic field. So that's a new effect. Okay. So this is the X mechanism. It's the fact that if you have a gauge, if you have a vector field, a gauge field coupled to a scalar field such that the scalar field has a non-trivial expectation value, so it means, remember that we have that phi squared is phi 0 squared positive, which means that we have a density, we have a non-zero density of particles in space. This is called the condensate. Then, coupling to a U1 field makes it massive. So it's massive, which means that it has three polarization instead of two. And it has three polarization because since it is massive, you may have a gauge particle, a vector boson at rest. And at rest, you have a plane wave at rest with oscillation of E and B's in the three directions. Because you still have Lorentz invariance. So if you choose a state at rest, it can oscillate in the three directions. So you have three polarizations instead of two. Because if it was massless, the waves propagates always at the speed of light, and so you have the polarization must be orthogonal to the direction of the propagation. So you have only two polarizations. Because if only V equals C alone, then you have two polarizations. Okay. Okay, so this mechanism, in fact, is called the X mechanism. But if you want to be a bit clear about history, I think I have the name here. Well, this is detailed in many papers, and can, for instance, if you look at the, I think it's well explained in the Nobel presentation of why they give the Nobel Prize to Engler and Higgs. And well, that's just my personal point of view. Engler and Higgs are great scientists, but in fact, they explain a bit clearly why they should have been given it also to other people. Because first, you check, thank you, first, having an electromagnetic field interacting with the charge condensate occurs already in supraconductivity. And supraconductivity, BCS theory has been developed in 1957, and this explains an effect which is called the Meissner effect. Which was discovered by Meissner and Ochsenfeld in 1932, and first theoretically by London, the two brothers, in 1935. The fact is that if you have a supraconductor, and here you have our ordinary vacuum, if you start to have a magnetic field B, the magnetic field avoids the supraconductor, at least if it's of type 1. In type 2, it can have subtleties. Okay. And in fact, it avoids the supraconductor because it can penetrate the supraconductor only on a finite distance, which is called the London penetration depth. So we have a penetration depth L, which is finite. So it means that, some sense, magnetic field cannot propagate in a supraconductor. They can propagate only for a finite distance. So if you think in terms of high energy physics, L is the inverse of a mass. So you could state it by stating that electromagnetic field, in particular magnetic field, is massive in a supraconductor. And but the supraconductor, we know since the work of Bardeen, Schrieffer, and suddenly I don't know what those three guys, is that superconductivity is explained because you have a condensate of bosons, which are those Cooper, of course. And so you have Cooper pairs. Which behaves as bosons. And we can be in the same state, form a macroscopic wave function, so which form a condensate. And in fact, P.W. Anderson, in a famous paper in 61, I think, or 62, said, haha, but this mechanism can be used, should be used to, in quantum field theory, to make gauge boson massive. But it didn't work out detail, so his description is still non-relativistic. So it's a great paper I found. And he makes a connection with the plasma wave that I describe here. I'm going to hand up. Okay, and it one had to wait a series of papers in 64 by Brout and Glaire, by Higgs, but also an important paper by Guralnik, Hagen, and Kibble. To work out part of the detail of how to make this relativistic, which is basically what I explained here, and X settled the complete simple description of that. So, okay, I'm still out of time, but let me summarize by stating that in fact, you can think of the X mechanism in two ways. So of course, this field H is called the Higgs field. Okay. And the A field is a massive vector boson. A is a massive vector bosons. So you can view this, you can view the X mechanism in two ways. You can use a language which is usually the language you find in high energy physics book, but I think it goes back to Anderson too, which is that when you have supersymmetry breaking and gauge field, you have the A mu, which in our case has two polarization. You have the bosons, the Goldstone, which has one state. And you have the sigma field, which is massive, and which has one possible state. It has no polarization. And the usual language is to state that if there is spontaneous symmetry breaking, the gauge field eats the Goldstone bosons. And becomes massive. So it's a nice way to see that. And it has, of course, three polarizations. Because two states of polarization and one state with no polarization becomes an object which has three possible states, therefore three polarizations. And the H sigma becomes the X field with no polarization. Okay. So that's the way, and I'm always a bit unsatisfied with this, but that's my personal taste, because one insists that the fact that the X mechanism is the consequence of the fact that there is spontaneously symmetry breaking. But in fact, there is no spontaneous symmetry breaking in the final theory, because there is no Goldstone bosons. So you can stay the condensed matter uses condensed matter language, which is the following. When you have a gauge field plus a condensate equals phi bar phi is positive, then you have a plasma. You have a relativistic plasma. Therefore, you have plasma waves. The gauge potential can propagate only before if the frequency is higher than some plasma frequency. And at the plasma frequency, the electromagnetic waves of the gauge field is a stationary wave which has three components. Three. Okay. So the language would be simply that there are plasma waves, which means that the electromagnetic field, so the gauge field A mu, is now massive. You don't need to think about super spontaneous symmetry breaking. You just need to think in terms of the fact that there is a relativistic plasma of the particle that comes from the charged scalar field, which describes the relativistic system of particles and antiparticles with mass m. Okay? So mu is now massive. And but so you have a plasma with waves, electromagnetic excitation, but then still the density of the plasma can fluctuate, but that's according to the fluctuation. So the X field is just density fluctuation. Of the plasma. So in some sense, A mu corresponds to what plasma physicists call plasmons, or condensed matter physicists call the plasmon. And H corresponds to, I don't know, some densiton or something like that. And to view that this point of view is also fruitful, what is the density? The density of the condensate. It's proportional to phi squared. So it's phi zero squared in this semi-classical description. And therefore, the mass of the gauge field should correspond to omega plasma. And from this formula here, this is E phi zero. Which means that ma squared is omega plasma squared is e squared phi zero squared, so it's e squared times the density, n. And this is exactly the formula which I had here, omega plasma square, he up to some coefficient, the density times the charge squared. So the two picture are equivalent. So this is the essence of the Higgs mechanism. You need a condensate of bosons in order to have massive gauge fermions, vector gauge bosons. So of course, this is a very simplified discussion. It's only for the U1 case. And of course, it has to be worked out for non-abelian gauge field, because that's the essential ingredient of the standard model of electroweak interactions. But then the gauge group is SU2 cross U1, I think, and in addition is broken in a way which is not as simple as that. But that's the essence of the Higgs mechanism. Okay, so well, I will end up the lecture here. I thank you very much for your attention and your questions. And I wish you good luck and be successful and energy for the rest of the year and for your future career. I was very happy to. That's, you are one of the most pleasant class I had. And I don't say this every year. Thank you.